This is Steve Sherlock with another Franklin Matters radio show, number 580 in the series. This session of the radio show shares the Community Conversations virtual meeting on housing and race, coordinated by the Franklin Area Against Racism Group, FAR, and held on Wednesday, July 14, 2021. Town Councilor Kobe Frangillo moderated the discussion, which featured guests Jim Johnston, longtime Franklin resident and historian, Ryan Taberna, Franklin's Director of Planning and Community Development, and Jesse Kenson-Benav, Executive Director of Abundant Housing Mass. The discussion focused on how Franklin's housing policies and practices have fostered social economic inequities and worked to reduce diversity in the community over the years. This is something that happens in a lot of Mass communities as well. Franklin TV recorded and will be making available the video of this virtual meeting. When available, I'll include the links to that here as well. This audio recording runs about an hour and 20 minutes, so let's listen to the community conversation on housing and race.
We are live on Facebook as well. Great. Hello, everyone. We are good to start at 7:05. Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming. My name is Kobe Frangillo. I'm a town councilor here in Franklin, and I'm pleased to have been invited by Franklin Area Against Racism for this talk on housing and race in Franklin. I wanted to, we have some distinguished guests with us, but I wanted to sort of lay the groundwork for why this conversation is happening. So this is the third, really fourth community conversation that we've had in collaboration with Franklin Area Against Racism. And when I talked to Justin, sort of coming out of the summer, we knew that we had some conversations that were missing in Franklin about some different aspects of life in Franklin. So we had a conversation with students about their experiences. We had a conversation with the police and some of our legislators about how police reform was going to impact Franklin. The Franklin Moms Group helped put together a conversation on how to talk to young children and teach tolerance and talk about diversity to young children. And then this conversation came from, you know, Justin and I were doing a lot of reading on, you know, color of law and understanding how segregation has impacted wealth disparity across the country. And we were interested in the question, well, why does Franklin look the way that it does? And how does that relate to Franklin? And that led us down a whole bunch of paths trying to better understand how the policies talked about and color of law and segregation by design played out in Metro Boston and the suburbs all the way down to Franklin. Very quickly, for those who don't know, I'm going to do my best to do a very abridged version of sort of the history of segregation just before I lay out. But essentially, starting in the 30s, so we have racial zoning that's made illegal in the, I believe it's 1918, but starting right after that, you have two things come up. One is zoning as a way to enforce segregation, and the other is a federal housing policy. And this is what, when we start having the FHA, Federal Housing Association, I believe it is, start to control who got mortgages and insurances, and insurance for those mortgages. They started to provide mortgages to communities that had deeds that said that the buildings would only be going to white families, to communities that were segregated to be white only. And they started to, you know, draw lines. This is where redlining comes in, around you know, less desirable places, where which are typically minority communities, where they wouldn't be affording the same mortgage and insurance benefits. By the time you get to 1968, where you have civil rights policy that starts to strike down some of the exclusionary and segregation by law. By that point, there's already a massive wealth disparity. And so as people start moving into the suburbs and suburbs start to restrict their zoning, start to restrict who can come in based on the affordability, making it harder for people to come in, especially low-income families to come in, then it only exacerbates the wealth disparities and the racial disparities in the suburbs. That's the general overview, the best I can in my current state, but I'm hoping that we can delve a little deeper into understanding how this applies to Franklin. And so that's why I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Johnston first. So Mr. Johnston has lived in the Oliver Pond House since his birth in 1944. This is that one house right off 495, for those who don't know, near the old exit 17. He's an old Yankee whose ancestors came to this country almost four centuries ago. Jim says that he has no personal memory of his family's arrival in the New World, but he trusts the source material. He holds his BA and MA degrees in history from what's now Bridgewater State University. His roots in Franklin go deep. He's third generation of his family to live in Franklin in the Oliver Pond House. He's a longtime public official. He served in various roles as an elected member, chairman of the planning board, board of selectmen, town council, board of assessors, and the finance committee. He's also served on dozens of appointed committees. And he was a teacher at Franklin High School for 34 years, teaching and also teaching courses at Dean College. He's recognized authority on art, antiques, rare books, postal history, and a whole bunch else. Books written by Jim include Odyssey in the Wilderness, The History of the Town of Franklin, which won an award from the National Association of the State and Local History, presented at a dinner meeting of the Massachusetts Historical Society. He's also written the Franklin Almanac, Images of America Franklin, The Yankee Fleet, Maritime History of New England in the Age of Sail, and the novel African Sun. Over the last 60 years, he's been the recipient of many commendations and awards from the Senate and House of Representatives for his work. So about as big of an expert as you can get on the town of Franklin. I appreciate you joining us today, Mr. Johnston.
Well, at 255 pounds, I guess I am a massive expert. pound for pound. That. Yeah.
Mr. Johnston, I'm hoping you can sort of walk us through the population explosion of Franklin over time, sort of the settlement of Franklin. Now, up to really about 1940, it seems like, to my knowledge, a lot of the families coming in were Irish and Italian. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. The Irish, of course, came here in the late 1840s as a result of the potato famine. And the growth of the Irish population was gradual and steady. And as a matter of fact, something I'd like to point out as far as, along the lines of racism, which is what we are looking at, there was an amazing amount of tolerance in Franklin. As a matter of fact, the selectmen of the town of Franklin allowed the Irish population to hear mass in the town hall once a month. It's the same courtesy they extended to other religious groups, which were considered to be on the outs locally. Unitarians heard services there once a month, as well as Baptists. And this showed a certain degree of equanimity on the part of the local political power structure.
You point that out in terms of tolerance. It's my understanding that when the Irish and Italians first arrived in America, they received racism themselves.
They were outsiders. They were the other. They were the unknown. And what you have to remember is that most Americans in the 1840s and 50s and 60s didn't travel more than 10 miles from the place where they were born in their entire lifetimes. People who traveled a greater distances from that were rather unusual. With the coming of the railroad in the 1870s, locally, of course, that picture changed somewhat. People would go to faraway Boston, perhaps they would go to Providence. There are all sorts of exotic destinations that they could reach out to, and also it made it easier for people to come here. When the Italian population started coming into Franklin, it was the railroad that brought them in the first place. There was a fellow named Fiorani who worked for the railroads, and he was the man instrumental in bringing contract labor, Italian contract labor, into the town, working for the railroad and then for other entities. And a contract laborer is something you definitely did not want to be, because you were bound to that job, as you pointed out in an earlier conversation, like an indenture. They became like indentured servants. And of course, that was not altogether a healthy situation. Nevertheless, it allowed people to come here from distances.
So then the population really started to explode starting in 1940. What was happening in 1940 that led to that population explosion?
Well, a little world cataclysm known as World War II erupted in 1939. And we became involved in that, of course, in December of 1941. Of course, Roosevelt had engaged us in war preparedness for a year before that, because he knew eventually this international squabble was going to extend itself and eventually involve us. So you had that. You also had a growing economy, and you had a growing industrial economy necessitated by the war. And so that we started really on a war economy before we were actually engaged in war, because of our preparedness. And this affected industries of all sizes just about everywhere, because we needed everything for a growing armed forces. After all, Hungary had a larger military establishment than we did in the late 30s. So if you think of that, you can see why there was a burst of enthusiasm industrially. And Franklin was a place where there are a lot of small factories and so forth, but it was also handy to larger manufacturing centers, so that you had a burgeoning of population. And then after the war, you had something known as the GI Bill of Rights, which allowed people, for the first time, working class people, to engage in home buying. This is something that was not usual. A lot of people who were from the lower rungs of the socioeconomic ladder pretty much were condemned to be renters for their entire lives, and again, not move out of their neighborhoods. But now they were more mobile, because America was on wheels, thanks to Henry Ford, as Will Rogers was to say, in 1929 and 30, we were the first, that would be the first generation that would be afford to drive to the poorhouse in their own cars. So America was mobile, and they wanted to get out and move to the countryside and buy a house.
So we have GI loans pouring in. I think the numbers that you gave me were around 1940, $5,500 a home. Now we have loans pouring in from the federal government. It goes up by 1960. It's about 10,000 to 13,000. A home. Why? So then the 1960s were our biggest population explosion to this point. What was happening in the 60s and 70s?
Well, people were experiencing prosperity. They were, there was the Vietnam conflict, which made the country selectively more prosperous here and there. People were making money, and they were spending money. People were still wanting to get out of the cities, and people now had transportation. They could work just about anywhere where they could find a job. A lot of people, for example, went from Franklin all the way to Framingham and Ashland and worked for companies like Telecron and General Electric. And more money was being made. It could be spent on housing. People were coming from Boston, spending money on housing. And generally, there was flight from the cities. And populations in the countryside were burgeoning. And building houses was something that people in Franklin did. There were a lot of contractors in Franklin, a lot of people with manual abilities. And as a result, you had dozens and dozens of housing developments erupting out of the soil like mushrooms.
Is it fair to say that most of this migration from Boston in the 60s and 70s was white? I want to say it was north of 98%.
It was probably north of 98%. And the reason for that was these were the people who had the money. These were the people who had the mobility. And also, culturally, these were the people who were more willing to move away from that which was comfortable and familiar into a new adventure. Perhaps they had a little more sophistication, a little more education, and they were going to expand and spread their wings and also provide their children with a better place to live than they themselves had enjoyed as youngsters. So there was that, because it was a burgeoning population. Babies were booming after the war, as you, I'm sure, know.
We have walked through this, and I think it was around this time that you described Franklin High. You said racism was blatant in the halls of Franklin High.
It was, and it's the last thing that I'm sure most of the students would consider that they were guilty of. And I'm sure their parents would be equally surprised if they were accosted by persons accusing them of racism. Racism was latent, and it was also obvious, and it was not all directed against people of color. It was directed against people who were different. People who were different. People who came from the subcontinent of India, for example, within my eyesight, within my hearing, were attacked for their race. Something that I found myself taking care of and correcting in my quiet, subtle way.
And I apologize for moving so quickly through this. And I recommend anyone check out his book. And I hope that we can host Mr. Johnson again. So now we have, we have the housing boom through the 60s and 70s. By 1980, housing prices are up from 10,000 to 65 to 80,000. And now there's a big housing boom in the 80s and 90s. I was wondering what the reaction of the planning board was at this time.
I actually was on the board of assessors in the early 80s. And the reason I bring that up is I'm reminded of my good friend, Mr. Johnny Cataldo, sometimes called Johnny Select, because he was the first Italo-American to become a selectman in the town of Franklin. He was extremely well regarded, as he should have been, as a man of respect, as he was. And he could not believe, I remember sitting at a meeting with him, and we were going over home evaluations, and he said, "Oh my God, can you believe that people are paying $80,000 for an 8-room house on 20,000 square feet of land? Can you believe that? That is incredible." And what are we looking at today? We're looking at people who are bidding upwards of $575,000 for a 6, 7, or 8 room house in a housing development that was new maybe 30 or 40 years ago. I mean, that's amazing to people who are contemporary to us now. So you can see that there's nothing new.
You mentioned lot sizes being a reason for the price raise. It was my understanding that this was a conscious decision by the planning board.
Oh God, yes. You know, again, it was subtle. It's subtle classism. I would say that classism has to be discussed side by side with racism. In fact, classism, if anything, was more predominant. And keeping people out of town with large families that would require education for their children was very much on the minds of people. I think I remember my telling you about one road in Franklin where four households produced 48 children. They filled up their own bus, these four households. That was a very expensive proposition for taxpayers. And so by expanding lots in what we call rural residential one, 40,000 square feet, which occurred in the early 60s for the most part, reduced residences, which meant that you would reduce the number of children attending schools. And schools were the most expensive item in the annual town budget. And educating children was not an inexpensive proposition. And I think that people were very conscious of that.
Yeah, I appreciate you adding that insight. I think we're getting close to current time. I think in the 90s, we were the fastest growing community of our size of any.
In Massachusetts, we were definitely the fastest growing. And our population had jumped from 18,217 in 1980, which was considered gargantuan, to 22,055 in 1990, and then a huge jump in the next 10 years to 29,560. That was an increase of almost 25%. I mean, that's substantial. That's a lot of kids in school. But there also occurred something else. And we look at this a little more sociologically at this point. The element of zero population. About this time, people in the world became very, very much aware that Thomas Malthus, the great late 18th century economist, was correct that you could be buried by population, redundant population. And what we were looking at in those days was something called zero population growth. In other words, a married couple producing two children, they were replicating themselves, and that would even off the population. And that actually did impact the growth of population in the United States to a great extent. Of course, this was more or less a middle-class phenomenon for the most part. And well, I'll let you comment here.
And I will say that we're
very decent of me.
Yes, appreciate it. And we will have to move on to our next speaker. I think during that time, I pulled it up. Yeah, we had 10th most new houses, most per capita of anywhere in Franklin,
1995,
and over 95% of that settlement was white.
Yes.
In that explosion. And then it started to slow in 2000, 2010. And I believe the answer you gave for that was some economic slowing, some price inflation, and what you would call effective zoning in driving up some of the pricing. Was that?
Oh, yes. And as you noticed, driving around Franklin, you had a proliferation of the phenomenon of the McMansion. Our McMansion population grew substantially, where you had housing that was appreciably more expensive than anything that had been built before in terms of a development, so that you had fewer people but moving into much more substantial housing. So you had that phenomenon.
Well,
this wouldn't be reflected as much in population growth as it would be if you went to the assessor's office and started looking at where property tax payments were coming from.
I think that's a great segue into who I'm hoping to bring in as our next speaker, Jesse Canson Beninov. We definitely should have
checked. You got it.
Or did I?
You did.
Okay. Yeah. Jesse's a housing expert with a political background. He grew up in St. Paul, but moved to Boston area after college. And he's now the executive director for Abundant Housing, focused on advocating for better housing policy in the greater Boston area. Jesse, thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, it's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
I believe you have some slides for us to go through.
Yeah, well, I wanted to talk about, and you know, I come to this without any deep knowledge of the town of Franklin, and that history that Mr. Johnston shared was fascinating, and I think it really touches on a lot of the stuff, you know, that we think of at Abundant Housing Massachusetts, and in terms of, you know, why is the greater Boston region, in fact, you know, the entirety of Massachusetts, really so segregated. Segregated certainly by race, but also by class to a large degree, as was mentioned earlier. And, you know, I think a lot of it has to do with our land use and housing practices. And certainly hearing that history of the development of Franklin and some of the housing types and policies that were implemented, you know, I think lead to some degree to where we are today. And Kobe, I thank you for your introduction about the history of redlining and or your description of what redlining is. You know, what I would posit is that redlining, although it was focused on the really urban core, and that's what I'll show in a second, really has sort of trickled out to the, you know, further suburbs as well, as communities began to adopt, you know, zoning and other policies that perpetuated the segregation that was caused by redlining. So, you know, the first thing I want to show, and I'll share my screen here real quick. So this is a project from the Mapping Inequality Project at the University of Virginia, or Richmond in Virginia. They took redlining maps from all over the country and overlaid them on current maps. This is, of course, the Boston area. You know, you can see certainly that, you know, they stopped really at, you know, the sort of external bounds of the urban core. So Franklin, you know, didn't quite get redlined, but, you know, other cities in Rhode Island and Massachusetts, as well as Boston, certainly were redlined. You know, the thing I'd like to point out here is just sort of how that worked, that, apologies that it keeps moving around. You know, they concentrated, actually, let me see if I can pull up the right, where's the key? Apologies. Essentially, you can see it down here, the way they classified communities by grade, with the green colors being the most desirable areas, the blue colors being a little less desirable, but still both green and blue, the areas where they would target for a federal investment in homeownership and mortgage insurance. For, you know, primarily white, middle, upper middle and wealthy families, you know, immediately before, after, or during and after World War II. Yellow and red areas being the less desirable areas. Yellow was seen as areas that were in transition and that would be a negative transition, and the red areas being the most detrimental areas. So, you know, as we look at Boston proper, you know, we obviously see things have changed to some degree. And I'm just going to change the view a little bit. You know, the South End, which of course is among some of the most expensive property in the city of Boston these days, you know, deemed the least desirable area because that was a concentration of Black families, immigrant families, Eastern Europeans, Jews were immigrating, railroad workers, things like that. So it's seen as undesirable area and not the areas where, you know, the federal government would target, you know, mortgage investments. If we go over, you know, to the west a little bit and look at Brookline and Newton, you can see that the vast majority, apologize, this again keeps moving around. Sorry, this is Newton and this is Brookline. The vast majority of both of these communities are blue and green. So much of Brookline and Newton, you know, understood to be the least, the most desirable areas of the Boston urban core. You can see areas of Brookline, for instance, as you get towards Boston, seen as less desirable. Also, you know, along the corridor that would become the highway, you know, getting up towards Watertown of Newton, seen as less desirable as well, with some exceptions in there. So I just wanted folks to understand how redlining worked. Because what I want to show next is a map that I created. I'm not a cartographer, so it's not the best map. But what I've done is overlaid, again, those historic, you know, green, blue, yellow, red, redlined areas. With current zoning, what can be built in Brookline and Newton under current zoning. And really, what these hash marks show are the areas of Newton, where Newton and Brookline, where you can only build single family, or in some cases, I believe in Brookline, duplexes, but you can't build anything larger than that in any of these hash mark zoned areas. The point that I would like to make is that current zoning, which is incredibly restrictive on the ability to build apartment buildings or to build multifamily affordable housing, that's restricted in much of the areas that were once deemed desirable for federal investment in white homeownership. On the corollary, those areas that were redlined, seen as the least desirable places, are still to this day, in both Brookline and Newton, for the most part, the only areas where you can more easily build apartments. So that's the only thing that I wanted to share in terms of slides. You know, I think although Franklin, being a more distant suburb, wasn't redlined by the Homeowners Loan Corporation in the 1930s, I would say, and certainly the history that Mr. Johnston shared sort of reinforces this notion, that like many suburbs and exurbs of Greater Boston, they adopted many of the same practices of the Newtons, of Brooklines, and other more desirable areas of the Boston urban core in terms of restricting development of the types of homes that were more targeted towards people of lower incomes, communities of color, and immigrants. And I would say that because of the great disparities of wealth between, for instance, white families and black families in the state of Massachusetts, the continual restriction in many communities on the ability to build apartments or other forms of multifamily housing, even triple deckers, the iconic, you know, Greater Boston housing typology, means that these communities are still to this day segregated. So current zoning perpetuates the race and class segregation that was implemented during redlining. And that continues to that day. And that's partly why we see communities of like Franklin, although not the only reason, I admit, but part of the reason why you see communities of Greater Boston, many of the suburbs, Franklin not excluded, that are 80, 85, 90, 95% white in population. So, you know, as abundant housing Massachusetts, we believe strongly that every community in Massachusetts should be open and welcoming to everyone, regardless of race, income, age, ability or disability, or any life experience. And so we're trying to work with communities across the state, but certainly in, you know, the broader Greater Boston region, to think about what are the practices that are still in place today, particularly as it comes to exclusionary zoning, that make it difficult to integrate your community. So that's really the point that I wanted to raise. And, you know, I don't know if you have any follow up questions, Kobe, or want to move on, but I'm happy to entertain.
Yeah, I will say that if anyone has questions, I see that Justin's starting to hand some to me. You can ask him in the chat. You can ask him on Facebook Live. You can send them directly to Justin and they'll be passed on to me. If I can just shoot you one, and we'll get to questions at the very end, but if I could just shoot you one, the type of housing that's excluded in an exclusionary zoning policies, could you talk a little about the types of housing that might look like, both middle and low income housing?
Yeah, I mean, when we talk about exclusionary zoning, we're often talking about large lot single family zoning. That is restrictions that many communities have across the state of Massachusetts, where you can only build a single family home. And the lot size is, I think you and Mr. Johnston spoke about, the lot size in many communities has grown larger and larger. Currently in Massachusetts, the average lot size on which you are allowed to build a single unit, or rather the minimum average lot size on which you're allowed to build single family unit in the entire state of Massachusetts is the equivalent of an NFL football field with the end zones cut off. So that's a large use of space for only one household to live on. We're not necessarily advocating for every lot in every suburb to be targeted for apartment buildings. But the fact is, again, you think about what's the iconic, one of the iconic housing typologies in Massachusetts and New England is that triple decker, the three decker. And that's even excluded in many communities of greater Boston. And even in those communities, for instance, like Somerville and Cambridge, where they are everywhere and in parts of Boston, the current zoning doesn't even allow them to be built. Those are considered non-conforming uses. Other types of housing that's restricted, it can be apartment buildings, everything from 4 or 5 unit and larger buildings. Mobile homes, this was something that many communities intentionally tried to restrict or prohibit, because who is seen as the population that occupies mobile homes? Well, lower income people, certainly, the people that many communities, of a previous generation and still some to this day wanted to keep out. So there's a whole variety of housing types that are more accessible to people of lower income and to people of color and to immigrants that are not allowed in many communities in our state.
That's fantastic. Thank you. And I think that takes us well into our third and final speaker for the night, and that's Brian Taberner. Brian is our Director of Planning and Community Development here in Franklin and recent author of the draft housing production plan, which is currently under consideration by the Planning Board and Town Council, that's sort of reviewing the affordability of housing in Franklin and some opportunities for recommendations moving forward. Brian, thank you as well for joining us. And if you also have slides to share, please feel free to do so.
Thank you, Kobe. I apologize in the background. You may hear dogs barking in a few minutes. They've been quiet up until this point, but I just heard them. Thank you. I would like to share a PowerPoint presentation to go through very quickly. Much of it was shown at a couple of public hearings on the housing production plan already, so some of you already seen it, but I think it provides a good baseline for where housing is today, affordable housing is today in Franklin. So if you don't mind, I'll pull it up and share and open up the presentation. Here we go. Hopefully everybody can see what I'm seeing. All right. Like I said, it is 14 slides. I'll do them in under 5 minutes, hopefully, and then we can take questions after. Okay. Thank you. So let me get this out of my way here. Okay. So a housing production plan is a community's proactive strategy for planning and developing affordable housing. It is not an element out of a master plan on housing, which covers all housing. This is strictly affordable housing plan. You can go into it further. Chapter 40B requires that each city or town have at least 10% of its total year-round housing units as affordable housing. And HVP's most important purpose is to develop goals and strategies that result in the community reaching a 10% statutory minimum. Mass Housing Community Department of Housing and Community Development keeps track of the number and status of each community's affordable housing on its subsidized housing inventory. So this is the HVP that we're dealing with now. Draft is an update of a 2011 Affordable Housing Strategy and Development Action Plan, which is the town's first housing production plan. We've made good progress implementing the plan and increasing the number of SHI, subsidized housing inventory, eligible housing units. In 2019, the town surpassed the state mandated target of 10% affordable housing. According to the Department of Housing and Community Development website, as of December 21st, 2020, 11.96% of the town's total year-round housing units, sorry about the barking, year-round housing units are on the Chapter 40B subsidized housing inventory. Therefore, the town is in compliance with 40B and not immediately under pressure from a forced 40B development, somebody coming in. And so we can actually have a little control over what type of affordable housing does happen in town. The total year-round housing inventory is based on 2010 census. If you think about it, the we've already had the 2020 a year ago, and we're still dealing with 2010 census data. So the actual total number of housing units obviously is quite a bit more. Therefore, Franklin is not at 11.96%. It is substantially less, but hopefully, and I believe likely still over the 10%. The current draft HPP is an update of the first, as mentioned. It expands upon the concepts outlined in the 2011 HPP, serves up as an update of more recent data, and explores incentives and other options to increase Franklin's affordable housing supply. The current draft is intended to direct affordable housing development preservation so the number of affordable housing units remain above 10% over the next decade and beyond. The plan does not include Census 2020 data because obviously they haven't released that yet. So we may decide in the very near future to update the plan based on 2020 data. If not, we'll be updating it again in 5 years anyway. So the HPP content, there's three major sections: comprehensive housing needs assessment, affordable housing goals, and implementation strategies on how to implement the goals. So the comprehensive housing needs assessment are, I think, a pretty interesting section to read in itself. It takes up the bulk of the document. So some of the things here that are pretty interesting, a 48% increase in population over the past 25 years. By 2030, residents over 65 years are expected to be approximately 23.2% of Franklin's population, compared to just 8.2% in 2000. Franklin is home to 11,941 households, which is up from 10,995, which is since in the last decade, 11 years, I believe it actually numbers were, 8.6% increase. Approximately 1,295 housing units were constructed in the last 10 to 12 years, representing 11.6% increase in housing units. Franklin's average household size is a little above average for the region and a little above average for Massachusetts. Median income has increased 13.24% since 2015 and 37.25% since the 2010 census. That's based on 2019 census data. It's likely a little bit more than that. Nearly 39.3% of households in Franklin earn $150,000 or more, compared to 23.4% statewide. The vast majority of Franklin's housing stock, 80.65%, is owner-occupied. And one thing that we know, if anybody knows anything about the housing market, that the supply right now is extremely low, hasn't been this low in maybe 20 years. And housing prices are very, very high. They've never actually been higher. So here we go, just a housing shortage, a little bit of things here. January 2021, median price of a single family home in Franklin was $549,000, compared to $531,000 statewide and $310,000 countrywide. By the way, that $549,000, it has gone up again. So it's actually a few thousand more. Oh, right, a note here, median price in April, it was $568,000, up from $512,000 in April 2020. There were 3,167 single-family homes on the market in Massachusetts at the end of February 2021, down 68.4% from the previous year. So again, you know, it's substantially less houses on the market right now than there were. There were over almost 700,000 homes on sale in the United States, which is less than 50% from the previous year. And according to the Mass Association of Realtors, housing supply numbers represent the lowest number of single family homes in condominiums for sale since that organization began reporting their data in, well, 18 years ago. The HVP goals that were developed are basic goals intended to increase the number of SHI eligible housing units and increase the number of affordable housing units available to the community's families, individual persons with special needs, and elderly. The goals, I don't know if I want to take the time to go through them all, but basically increase the number of houses on the subsidized housing inventory, increase the number of houses for low income, very low income, and moderate income residents. There are different regulations pertaining to each group and as far as what you qualify for assistance and whether you can actually get one of the affordable housing units that the town has on its inventory. We want to increase the number of units for the elderly, special needs, affordable housing appropriate for expected future demographics. That is a constantly changing one right there that I think that's one of our more interesting features in this town right now. When do we stop building the mini mansions and actually focus in on the other type of developments that we really do need? Provide housing alternatives that meet the needs of Franklin-based employers. Again, that's we have an awful lot of jobs in town, but not everybody can afford to live here, obviously. Adopt the strategies that incentivize production of affordable housing, which is a big issue that we're talking about now. Adopt zoning strategies that advance affordable housing production and continue funding and expanding the Franklin Municipal Affordable Housing Trust. They've done some great work in the past, but their resources are getting depleted. And identify new funding sources, obviously. So strategies, there are a lot of strategies, but to give you just a real quick idea, one thing that we need to do, which was discussed a little bit, is that the need for our zoning to change. We have, as was mentioned, we have large lot subdivisions and that are basically 3/4 of the town. 40,000 square feet in rural residential one zoning district, and they drop down to 30 or 20,000 after that. So the majority of the town is set up for single family homes in a subdivision format. Only a couple of districts actually allow multifamily, and it's only allowed by special permit. You have to go to the planning board for a special permit to get it an apartment complex or even a three family. So again, strategies, advanced projects under local initiative program. That is the 40B, friendly 40B program, if you will. So look at some concepts that we can develop in an affordable housing complex, whether it be apartments or be another form, whether it be single family or a condominium thing. But the fact is that we need to, these local initiative program projects are the only ones really that we are, not the only way to increase our 40B SHI, but it is the most effective way to do so. So when we talked earlier about the Housing Trust has a local initiative program going right now with a developer called the Senior Ridge, Franklin Ridge Senior Housing Project, sorry. And we are working on obtaining grants to assist to that project. The trust actually will donate the land for it. And some funds, I think it's $100,000, but it's a many million dollar project, obviously. So the town and the developer will be working on getting state and or federal funds or to get anything else possible to help with that project. that is a senior housing development. It's not for other groups in town. So we need to start thinking about those more often too. So one thing we wanted to do is create a density bonus type incentive program. So allow more units of housing be built than would be allowed on the current zoning in exchange for developers' provision of affordable housing units or another public good. You don't necessarily have to do it for housing units, but it is what the norm is. And there are other incentives we can talk about if we had a lot more time. So the status of the draft plan right now, I put up at the top, the feedback from the general public and town officials is a critical component of the planning process. So we took the time to get a public input, and it's been received in a variety of ways. We had a public comment period from May 12th to June 25th. Written comments were accepted, and not only on the draft HPP, but also on housing issues in general. We did get some that were more generalized. The public hearing at the Municipal Housing Affordable Housing Trust meeting in June 2nd, the draft HPP was presented at the Economic Development Subcommittee and Planning Board meetings. It's been discussed in a variety of different ways. So the input is being used to develop the preliminary final document. That preliminary final document will be presented to the Planning Board and Town Council for review, consideration, and formal adoption. Hopefully it'll go through as proposed. If not, then we need to go back and go the second preliminary final document. But once this has been adopted by the town, we submit to the Mass Department of Housing and Community Development, and they will review and hopefully approve. At the bottom of the screen is the website. It's the Department of Planning and Community Development's website, where you can find the draft document if you care to look at it at this time. So I think I wanted to stop sharing, number one. Where am I here? All right. All right, so hopefully I wasn't too much time. I kept within a reasonable timeline. Interesting things about what was said about by Jesse and Jim earlier and Kobe, that yes, at some point we had large lot subdivisions with vast majority of the town. That's what they wanted. That's what the town wanted, and they had their reasons. And obviously, they weren't necessarily great reasons. They were to limit the type of people that actually can afford to build a home in town. There's a lot of these things. It's a very, institutional racism right from the beginning of the history of this community, not the community, but the country in general is a big deal. And it is still there in a much smaller way. But we are still dealing with issues of that nature. Now, the issue of keeping school children out of their schools, of course, I've been in doing municipal planning for 25 years or so, and it's always, whether you said it outright or not, it was, people didn't want large family. They didn't want to go beyond a two-family, apartment or something to that effect, because you're going to put a lot of people into the school system, and your taxes would have to go up, and we'd have to pay for a lot of services and all the other things. But in reality, right now, the opposite, because we actually have room in our schools, and the tendency right now is for the amount of school children to drop and continue dropping over the next decade or two. So it's not really an issue. And if we get an apartment complex, we don't have the real reason now to say, oh, let's try to limit, only have 10% of them can be three bedroom or something. I mean, there's really no reason for that. I'm saying something as a planner and as a person, not as somebody that would represent the planning board or something, because really they are elected officials and the town council are elected officials. Planning the appropriate number and size houses and apartments in a community is nearly impossible. All you can do is say, this is ideal, and work with developers if you can, and hope that incentive programs are established, and do what you can to make things happen. But we have a long way to go, obviously. We definitely do. And the shortage of the number of housing units in the region I was looking at some numbers earlier today, and the average single family home in this community just last month was selling over $600,000. And you know, that's your median single family home. Your condos are substantially less, but still they're much higher than they had been in recent times. Yeah, so June of 2021, median sale price of single family, $681,500. And that was 50 different houses that average out that high. So 25 or less, 25 or more than that price. So obviously we can't really afford the person making median income can't afford that. And to qualify for an affordable housing program, you have to make 80% of median or less. So obviously you're not gonna be finding a house if you actually qualify for it, there's no house to buy. That's pretty sad, right? That's the way it is right now. So the hope is that additional housing units will be created that are smaller in scale, which of course that would mean that you have more density in neighborhoods. That's obviously a political decision. It's not planners can suggest that you do that, but when it comes right down to it, town council are the people that actually approve the zoning bylaws, and the planning board are the ones that recommend and also implement the decisions of zoning bylaws and subdivision regulations. So it's complicated. I know that right now you have a lot of people that are going to ZBA for accessory dwelling units, so, apartments for, a related family member, they get their own kitchen and they're separated. So that's pretty common, actually. And it likely will be more and more common. And instead of that, why can't we just develop a housing situation where a person has got an acre and a half, he only has 150 feet of frontage. And we could barely put one house in there right now. But you should be able to put a couple in there if by right, but that's not the way our regulations are. So anyway, I'm done talking for a while. You guys can ask questions if you want, but it's a very interesting subject matter and a very, the equity issue. And it's not just race. In this state, obviously, with the Irish and the Italians, even today are over 50% the ancestry in this town. So that in itself, we are 90.5% white, non-Latino, I guess, is somewhere in that area. So it used to be 95% not that long ago, but we're at 90.5. So there are changes happening. A good chunk of Asian Americans, but if you include all of the Chinese, Asian Indians are a big group. And there are very few Black African American families in this community. And according to the demographics I've seen recently, as little as 350 individuals in the whole town that are considered Black or African American. I have done a good job. If that's what we wanted to do, is to keep out the minorities. If we didn't want to do that, we kept out a lot of the lower income individuals, because with all of the mini mansion houses, that's all, obviously you have to have money to afford that. So again, here I am saying I'm going to stop talking when I keep going. Go ahead,
Kobe. We appreciate your insight, Brian, and you joining us post-employment hours. We're lucky to have you, and I appreciate everything that you went through. And you touched upon a few things. I was going to ask you about 40B, which is 80% of median income. And you touched upon this concept of middle housing, right? The idea that there's something between a single family on a large lot and, you know, 30-plus unit apartment complex, that there's duplexes, triplexes, you know, quadplexes, you know, five homes, maybe it's accessory dwelling units, granny flats, you know, the ability to add on something to your home so that an aged relative could live.
I think in the community right now, if I were going to guess, what we need, what is known as workforce housing more than anything else right now. The average worker in the town can't afford to live here. You might have a good job making $100,000, but you can't afford a house in town. You know, that's pretty sad. Unless your family member passes on a house right now, getting your hands on a new house in this community is nearly impossible unless you're making a couple hundred thousand or more right now.
So I will say that we have reached our hour right now, which is all that I asked my panelists for. I am happy to stay on longer, and if panelists can stay on longer, that's great. But if anyone needs to take off, you have done your time, and we appreciate it. Thank you, everyone who was able to come out. There will be a recording and links available. But thank you very much to Brian, Jesse, and Mr. Johnston for joining us tonight. Think that's the cut of the hour. So if people want to take off, they can, but I'm going to start jumping into some of the questions that we received for anyone that's able to stick around. And I promise not to hold that any past 8:20. That's going to be my cutoff for some questions if we can get to them. Appreciate it. Okay, I wanted to touch upon one thing to sort of pull it back. There's a whole bunch of links that have been talked about and resources that have been talked about that we're going to share around. One of my resources that I used and examined a lot was a study in the 70s that the Massachusetts State Legislature commissioned after the building of Route 128, which is the sort of the first beltway around Boston. They commissioned a study to see that the impacts of that beltway on segregation, as 495, which is where Franklin's population boom came in. They wanted to see, okay, what was 128's impact on segregation so that hopefully we can avoid some of those issues as we build 495. And I think that you will be disappointed by how little of the recommendations we heeded, but I wanna pull out one quote and then ask a question based on that. Because I think that this captures a lot. Should 495 follow the pattern of 128, widely dispersed industrial sites, high-skilled employment, no public transportation, and spread of multifamily homes on large lots, the cost of land and housing in the belt between the two roads will continue to rise and virtually close the area to all but upper-income groups. The white suburban noose will be irrevocably fixed, and the subordination of the racial minorities will be guaranteed in the region. That was a commission against discrimination sponsored by the Massachusetts State Legislature in 1975. It talked about a few things that I think we haven't talked about that I was wondering if anyone would be willing to touch upon. One is transportation, right? They talk about how the lack of access to transportation and the spreading of industrial sites away from transportation impacts affordability. Is anyone able to talk about the role that transportation plays in affordable housing?
Kobe, if you want to hear from me, I'll mention a few things.
That would be, I want to shoot it. If I could shoot it to Jesse first, then I
do, please.
Fantastic, but I would love to come back.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, it's an important important question, particularly as, you know, we think or about and advocate for, you know, increasing housing production across the region. And, you know, we, you know, have a regional transportation system that doesn't always work. And so that's hard, certainly. You know, it is important to think about how we can place new housing and affordable housing in particular near job centers or with access to job centers. And, you know, the role of, you know, the commuter rail system. Is there a, I'm sorry, I don't know. Is there a commuter station? And what's around the commuter rail station in Franklin?
Yeah, we're currently at a density of, I believe, I just had it up. We're at 3.5 homes per acre. The average of Greater Boston around is 6.5 homes per acre around the commuter rail station. Mass Housing Partnership recommends at least 10 homes per acre around commuter rail station.
The just one thing I would comment on is, you know, it's fairly low, although maybe it's keeping in with the existing character of Franklin. You know, one element that was passed by the legislature earlier this year as part of the housing choice legislation is a requirement that every community with MBTA service or every MBTA community implement one district of a reasonable size. Reasonable is not determined in the legislation or not defined, of reasonable size that allows development of at least 15 units per acre within half mile of their transit station. So, you know, that's an important, you know, it doesn't get at specifically whether it's affordable housing or market rate housing or mixed, but that's certainly, I would say, an opportunity for a town like Franklin to think about if there's, you know, unused land around within half a mile of the station or underutilized land around the station. And then how do you target specifically for affordable housing if that's the town goal or family that, or rather housing that's accessible to families. And so that's, again, a political question for the town, but it's an opportunity to think about how to tie housing, affordable housing, and transit together, because it's so important. You don't want to bring low-income folks into a development that disconnects them, certainly from their, you know, family, access to their, you know, their families and social networks, but absolutely not from their the ability to get to their jobs as well.
Yeah, Kobe, maybe I can touch on a couple of things. I know Mr. Johnston would know quite a bit about the when 495 came in, and then afterwards when the Franklin Industrial Park, Forge Park were developed, things of that nature. When Forge Park was developed before I came to town, you know, National Development worked a deal with the MBTA. They got the station in that area. They developed a, so you could walk to work essentially. That actually, I mean, that's, it was set up for jobs, not necessarily for people to live near the MBTA station, although there is subdivision there and there's now an apartment complex, affordable housing. In the downtown, we have the other station, of course, and that is in developed areas that we could work to increase density. It's about the only way to get your additional housing in there and change zoning regulations where a multifamily is not allowed by right. You need a special permit. Maybe a certain number per acre can be a by right development. Or there's a variety of ways to do that. But our zoning in the downtown, actually, the downtown commercial zoning district allows up to one unit per 2,000 square foot of lot area. So that is above the 15 per acre. And on the other area, it's right around there, is a developed subdivision in a industrial area and then business. And business district and the industrial housing is not allowed by right or special permit. So we may be forced to change our zoning in that one. And we may want to change it in the downtown. So give you an idea. Jim, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'll tell you what happened when digital came into Franklin. We were meeting in an afternoon, a small committee with the executives from there. And the questions who were asked were these. Well, where are our executives going to live? The ones in such and such and such and such an economic group. And we said, well, you know, there are some very nice developments and so around town. Obviously upper middle class type housing. And they said, okay, now where are technicians going to live? Well, you know, there are some older developments and there's housing available, so forth. And they said, well, what about our lowest level workers? And I said, well, that's simple, Bellingham. and that pretty much was what they did. And at that time I had a Jaguar Mark 10, which is, you know, as big as any bus. And I loaded it up with all these people. And we went for a ride. And we took a ride around Franklin and with a little detour to Bellingham. We looked around at these places and that is the way that it was approached 40 odd years ago. We're talking 45 years ago, maybe, at this juncture, 43 years ago. Not exactly a lifetime, but, you know, longer than many of your lifetimes, I guess.
It's not much difference than 20 years ago and 25 years ago. It's only more recent that people are starting to think about it in different ways, really.
Right. Well, the thing is that you're quite right that the larger lots were actually thought of as a good way to restrict the growth of school age population. And that was strictly for the benefit of the ratepayers, the taxpayers of the town of Franklin. The smaller the lot, the more families and more children to deal with. I think that the industrial end of the question was pretty well thought out. I don't think that housing was as well thought out. Although we seem to have developed a phenomenal number of housing developments in town. I lost count at about 40. But there were a lot of tract developments in town that were developed. And we're a town of only 26 plus square miles. And if you take a ride around town, there is something that seems to be disappearing, and that's, you know, open space and forests.
Appreciate that. I need to be better about jumping in. You guys have so much knowledge, but I do want to make sure we get to at least one question from the audience. One was for Jesse. As we debate the update of the housing production plan in Franklin, what do you think is the most important element to include? And this is from a fellow town councilor.
Interesting. Well, you know, I think that, you know, I am heartened to see that there's discussion around sort of density bonuses for doing affordable housing. I mean, that's a tool that a lot of cities have used, and I know they certainly exist in the Boston core and in Cambridge and others. And that's a great way to get additional units. And to get additional units that would count to the subsidized housing inventory, if that's the goal. Another strategy that is maybe a little less tested and is newer and is less tested in a suburban community, but it's something to think about. It's similar to a density bonus. It's something like an affordable housing zoning overlay, which was adopted recently in Cambridge, and Somerville did it as well. Boston's considering it, and now Berkeley, California is actually doing it, but it's essentially giving not just a density bonus, but just greater density overall to developers of 100% affordable housing. The goal being that they are more able to compete on the market against market rate developers to do affordable housing, because they can then spread the cost of acquiring land over more units than they otherwise would have under the base zoning. So it's an interesting strategy. It certainly is really important in a place like Cambridge, where land is so incredibly expensive, the affordable housing developers really just can't compete with the market. But it'd be interesting to think about how something like that works in Franklin. You know, I think there's also, you know, a parallel strategy while we talk about subsidized housing or affordable housing, just like making sure that the market can play more of a role in serving the needs of those who maybe aren't wealthy but don't qualify for capital A affordable housing, I call it, or subsidized housing. So thinking about strategies like ADUs or this concept of missing middle housing, which Kobe mentioned, which is, you know, allowing development of smaller size, maybe apartments or triple deckers, things like that. But you don't have to increase it. You know, you don't have to increase density with, you know, large multifamily buildings. But hopefully you can create some more smaller size, as Brian was saying, smaller size units that serve people who are searching for lower case A affordable housing. And so those are, you know, just in the course of this conversation, a few things that have come to mind. Also, something that's interesting to think about, I know some cities are starting to think about this, is just the idea of micro or compact units, you know, allowing some developments maybe near the train station that are targeted maybe more towards younger professionals, certainly not for families, that are maybe 300 square feet for folks who are maybe taking the commuter rail into Boston for their jobs, but, you know, want to live in Franklin, you know, that will just decrease the cost of market housing for them because they're not going for, you know, 2,500, 3,000 square foot homes.
Fantastic. Brian, last one is for you. Metrics for measuring our success in the housing production plan. Do we have any metrics for doing that?
The only metric that we really have is the SHI. It's our inventory and the percentage. The housing production plan is all about the SHI. So if we, let's just say when we find out what our census is, net census numbers are, and we have 10.5% affordables, we have to make sure that we, 10 years later, we're gonna make sure we don't drop down below 10. So we have to add to the SHI. So that's that percent I would love to see up at 12%, 11%, 13%, 14%, 15% eventually, but it would not, it's not really, other than that, there's really no metric that we actually would use. In housing in general, I think if we can get the average house, new construction, then the average housing unit to be smaller than it currently is, that would be a metric, because the smaller the units, the more affordable it possibly would be. The density of the development would be another way to do that. We're always going to have large lot subdivisions, and I see always in my lifetime anyway, but I think that the tendency is to go smaller, to be, you know, I've been hearing transit-oriented development concepts for all my professional career, and really, right now, it's in these suburbs. It is a real thing that we need to focus on. We're lucky we have two train stations. We can increase the density of housing in both of those areas if we get creative, and both of them. So, you know, trip into Boston for the young professional or the older professional, for that matter, can be a lot easier if they're living in the downtown. It also is great for the economic activity in the downtown, economic development. You get more restaurant use, you're more likely to have more selection of retail and things of that nature within walking distance of the station and the housing units that are developed because of the station. It also goes into everything else. I mean, you know, the cultural district and everything else. So we do need to intensify, increase the number of people living in those areas. It is good on many, many levels. You don't always get the people that are living there now to agree with you, though. If they're living in a single family or a duplex, and they, you know, they may not want a six-unit house directly across from them where there's a single-family home now. That's the kind of development that you will end up with if we increase the densities. I think it's good for in certain areas, but I think you're going to get pushback in many ways, depending on what you do. And of course, you want to make sure that whatever you do, you're actually increasing the value of a person's property, so they can at least complain about that. If their property values drop because of a zoning decision, you're making a mistake.
That's fantastic. And we have now passed our 8:20 deadline that I set for myself. But I do appreciate that as a young professional who works in Boston and is only able to afford living in Franklin because of an accessory dwelling unit. I appreciate all the work that our planning department has done. Thank you very much again to Franklin Area Against Racism, who continue to sponsor events like these. I think they're very, very important as we continue these conversations around Franklin. Thank you again to Mr. DeBurner, Mr. Johnson, Mr. Canson Beninav for joining us. And thank you all who are in the audience. Apologies for not being able to get to all your questions, but we will add links and try to answer all the questions following this meeting within the next week. Thank you, everyone. Have a good night.
We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio. This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tin Type Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. By the way, you can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.